I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in the wake of too many tragedies in our community and country, we're going to explore the ways a community can and should respond to gun-related violence. My guests are the Reverend Charles Harrison of the Indy 10-Point Coalition, Assistant Police Chief Randall Taylor of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, and Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about the ways communities can and should respond to gun-related violence, obviously. Indianapolis is not the only community asking this question. Communities all across the country are asking it, but we are going to try to deal with this difficult issue today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, and I would encourage everyone to do so, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My only caveat here is the one that the focus of this show always is that we want to generate more light than heat. And I know this is an issue people on every side of the question have really strong feelings about. So frame the question, say what you want, but we're going to do it in a civil way so that we can actually try to arrive at some understanding of each other. My guests are the Reverend Charles Harrison of the Indy 10-Point Coalition, Assistant Chief Randall Taylor of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, and Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. So, you know, the problem with this subject is it touches so many nerve endings, it's even hard to sort of know how we should cope with it. I think probably the best way is trying to get this to a human level at the beginning and talk about the ways that gun violence and dealing with it have touched each of you as human beings. Reverend Harrison, I'll start with you.
Well, certainly it is a very touchy and difficult subject, and, you know, my first experience with it was in the mid-70s when my older brother, who was 21 at the time, was killed. He was killed in Louisville, Kentucky by gun violence, and certainly I will never forget the night that my family received a phone call, you know, about my older brother.
How old were you at the time?
I was 14 years old at the time. So my brother was 7 years older than me. And it certainly left a scar, on me as I have, you know, dealt with that issue ever since, I was 14 years old. And it's something that all families, you know, end up going through. My brother was 21 at the time. He had a six-month-old son, Jawan, who almost 23 years later died the same way his father did. He was shot down and killed also just like his father. So when you begin to talk about that issue, certainly it hits home for me because I have been on that side where, you know, I've gotten, my family has gotten a phone call about a loved one that's been killed.
Chief Taylor.
So this is my 30th year in law enforcement. So obviously I got my start in Champaign, Illinois. But as soon as I joined the police force there, I got immersed into gun violence. And growing up in Champaign, sometimes those victims would be people I knew, people I went to high school with. On a more personal level, November 30th of 1998, my father-in-law was killed in Fort Wayne by a then 12-year-old. And then during my time in investigations, I've shared many tears with a number of families, both some who have survived the attacks and some that didn't. So I'm very familiar with it. I wish I could say that I wasn't, but I am.
Steve.
Hi. Yes, I had practice. I'm a retired psychiatrist, mm-hmm. and, of course, during my practice I had a lot of exposure to people who were at risk for gun violence, but mostly it was a kind of gun violence directed against themselves through suicide, which in fact accounts for more lives than homicide. But I did have – but I don't think that that's what we want to talk about here particularly. On the other hand, I also had was involved with a patient that I admitted to the hospital, and he wanted to be admitted because his lawyer told him you should go and get – you're in trouble for beating up your girlfriend, and if you go in the hospital and get treated for alcoholism, it'll look good. So he did, but then his girlfriend told him 2 days later, everything was fine, come on home. Well, he did go home, but his girlfriend was staying with her grandparents, and he wanted to go pick her up, along with his wife, incidentally. But anyway, he took along a pistol because her brother had threatened him. And when he got to the grandparents' house, the grandfather apparently started shouting at him and yelling at him. So he took out the pistol and shot the grandfather. And then he then shot the grandmother. And then he kidnapped his girlfriend and his wife and the baby and took off for Kentucky, but was later apprehended, and now he's in prison. But it struck me at the time, as it had in other situations, that had he not been carrying that firearm, which he was carrying for, quote, self-protection, mm-hmm. there wouldn't have been two homicides. There might have been an altercation, but there wouldn't have been two homicides. And in my own practice, the same thing seemed true for suicide. That quite a number of suicides that I was involved in with the survivors involving guns were very precipitous, often happening when people didn't even know the individual was having problems. Whereas the ones that I was treating for depression and were at risk for suicide had much longer histories and had mental illness problems, and some of them did end up committing suicide, occasionally with a firearm and sometimes with other means. So there seemed to be this distinction in psychiatry, at least, between firearm suicides and others, and then, of course, the problem of gun violence, which I think of criminal gun violence, which is mm-hmm. the issue in this community, in this, from my Hoosier's concern. We're having an epidemic of death among young African-American males in this city. It's 155 per 100,000, mm-hmm. Which is higher than the death rate for all other for all causes combined, young 15 to 24-year-old white males. So, and it has to do with access to firearms by these kids or young men.
Well, let me step in on that, because there's part of what I want to talk. I think, are we all in agreement that 155 per 100,000 is too many, that we are at epidemic levels, that, well, and one would argue in a moral sense that one out of 100,000 is too many. But, you know, the fact that we have gotten to this and to the point where it is a leading, if not the leading cause of death among, you know, certain demographic groups in this country indicates we have a significant problem. Before you can solve a problem, though, you sort of have to identify its causes. How did we get here? I'll start with Steve, but I want to hear everybody's thoughts. How did we get to this point?
Well, I was talking with the assistant chief earlier, and when I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and in the 50s and 60s there were gangs, and gangs fought each other. But they used bicycle chains, they used knives, they used baseball bats, and very occasionally they used a gun. And if you remember the musical West Side Story, mm-hmm. there's a song in there about one of the characters who has a gun, mm-hmm. and they're going to go to a gang fight. Well, he's going to be the only one there with a gun. Mm-hmm. Now, guns are so prevalent and so easily accessible to these same to young men in the same kind of difficulty or same kind of situation that they're bringing them to all of their altercations and that when firearms are present in an altercation, the outcomes tend to be much worse.
Chief Taylor.
Yeah, so I agree with a lot of that statement. I think we all can share stories of when we were younger, people settled disagreements with their fist. And whoever lost just lost, and they're, you know, I knew guys that would get in fights like that and then become the best of friends. But you never saw a knife, you never saw a gun, and now all of a sudden we're at a time where guns seem to be the first and best choice for a lot of people. Some of whom I think may be emotionally immature, you know, because a lot of the crimes that we have seem to be senseless. You know, someone was called out of their name or disrespected in some fashion, and the next thing you know, we've got a shooting. I think this year we're at about 105 non-fatal shootings, which is just down. We may be at 101. I think we're five below what we were last year, which is not obviously a whole lot. But, you know, we come across these people. A lot of them don't want to cooperate, and those are the victims. Don't cooperate in the investigation, and it's puzzling. But a lot of times we hear that it's because, you know, someone got on social media and disrespected, or they disrespected them in person or something. And like I said, their choice was to use a gun to settle that, which is obviously inappropriate.
But really the issue has been going on a long time. I shared the story about my brother for a reason. When you had the introduction, particularly of drugs into the African-American community, you go back to the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, you know, the level of violence that was taking place in our community. I remember with the emergence of the crack cocaine, you know, in African-American communities. And yeah, there have been gangs. But when you add the element of the drugs and the fact that people were making money off of this, you know, and people were trying to control territories and areas, the level of violence was really high in inner cities all across the country. But it really never got the attention that it really deserved because it was viewed as a black problem. Mm-hmm. And even still today, I would argue that it is still viewed as a black problem and not a national epidemic that affects all of us as Americans.
Yeah, we had, and I want to get back to your thought, but we did, prior to the school walkout, we did a show where we were talking about guns in America, and we had a very thoughtful young man from Warren Central, young African-American man, who said very politely, very respectfully, yes, we understand that Parkland and what has happened in some of these suburban and more affluent schools sort of created an impetus here, but this has been going on in our lives for a long time. And he talked about two of his friends. You know, this is a kid who hasn't even made it to his 18th birthday who've been shot to death. Anyhow, I interrupted you, but I wanted to do it to reinforce your point.
Well, yeah, you know, so as we begin to talk about this, and I know we're going to get into solutions and stuff, you know, I just want you talk about how we got here. It's been going on a long time, and I survived it. I almost fell off the cliff myself. You know, I wanted to harm those who had harmed my brother, and so, you know, that's what we're up against today with a lot of these young people who are growing up in this kind of environment and who have been traumatized by it.
And some of that, I remember Chief Taylor talking when I was a newspaper reporter years ago when we had, you know, the first of what turned out to be many really deadly summers of kids killing kids and all that, who made points similar to yours that wasn't just one thing. It was, you know, we had the access suddenly of all these drugs, cars actually, because they could move around, and then the guns. And that formed, you know, a really, really deadly combination. Have we ever been able to get to turn the corner on that?
Well, I think statistics would probably say no. Like I said, our numbers are all over the place with that. Some years have been better than others. Fortunately, I think this year and late last year, we didn't have as many young folks, not the really young like we have had in mm-hmm. years past, commit these crimes. But it's still too young. And it's still, unfortunately, something that affects the black community much more than any of the other communities here in Indy.
We are talking about how communities should respond to gun-related violence. Here on No Limits, my guests are the Reverend Charles Harrison of the Indy 10-Point Coalition, Assistant Police Chief Randall Taylor of IMPD, and Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881, send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about ways a community or communities can respond or should respond to gun-related violence today on No Limits. My guests are the Reverend Charles Harrison of the Indy 10-Point Coalition, Assistant Police Chief Randall Taylor of IMPD, and Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Mary has done and find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Mary writes, there is a really great book by Jeffrey Canada, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, that discusses how gun violence was an unintended consequence of the war on drugs in the 1970s. Because children received lesser sentences, drug sellers recruited them for their businesses, and guns moved down to persons who were too immature to understand the consequences of their choices. Reverend Harrison, I'll let you start on that one. Truth, you think, or...
Well, you know, I guess some of it, there may be some truth to it. But, you know, when I was growing up in the streets, you know, everybody doesn't have a gun because, you know, they are drug dealers and stuff. I think when things started to get so bad, and I know, you know, Chief Taylor can talk about this, is that people started carrying guns also for protection. Mm-hmm. You know, because if so-and-so down the street had a gun and he was threatening to you, then other people started, you know, getting guns. I remember when I was, you know, growing up, you know, guns were starting to be introduced in the community and people were getting guns to protect themselves. Not everybody got one just because they were involved in criminal activity. And then it has now spiraled out of control out there now. Because now why people are using those guns have certainly changed from when I was growing up as a kid.
Well, and I have not read Jeffrey Canada's book, but if I understand Mary's question, it said this was sort of one of the instigators that once guns came in there, everybody felt like they needed to have one. You know, it would get to your point of it was almost like it would, you know, to use the epidemic language we referenced, it was almost like once the virus came into the community, there it was impossible to get rid of it. You're nodding your head over there.
Yeah, I have read his book, Mr. Canada's book, and a lot of what he goes into is kind of one of the things I spoke about before with this, with fighting with fist. I believe Mr. Canada came up on the East Coast, and he would say in his book that you know, everyone was going to get in a fight in this particular neighborhood. And it didn't really matter so much whether you won or lost, just that you put up a fight. Because as long as you did, there was respect. But as this breakdown occurred and people got away from fighting with their hands and introduced different weapons and stuff, it became easier at some point to acquire the weapon. And then you didn't really have to fight because... you're just pulling a trigger. Mm-hmm. And I think some of what she says is correct. I think that that has come about, and it's hard to put toothpaste back into the tube. Once the guns became more available, and we know that it's very easy to access them, even here in Indianapolis, that's what people rely on.
Well, don't you think, though, that people today, which is different, I think there was boundaries. When you talk about in the 70s, 80s, that there were some thou shalt nots and boundaries that we didn't cross growing up back then than what you see today. There was a much greater regard, I think, when you start talking about street violence, for the sanctity of human life, because there was a lot of influences there. You had stronger family units, more people were going to church, and you was taught certain things that kept us from crossing those boundaries the way we see young people today, where there is this total disregard for the sanctity of human life.
Well, and some of that, I mean, has become almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm going to toss that to okay. Steve as a psychologist, because there is this sense also that because we are so saturated now in gun violence, they're almost arguing, we hear gun rights advocates arguing that this is just something we have to accept. It's the cost of freedom. I know. I'm advancing their argument. I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm advancing their argument that it is the cost of freedom. But I also wonder what it does to young people to live in those circumstances. I mean, I know, my children live in, pretty comfortable, secure. But, every couple months or whatever, parents get a note saying that they did a lockdown drill at the school and walk through what you do if there is an active shooter. And this is now just I didn't have to do those things when I was in high school, lo those many years ago, that this is just part of what we live in now. And what Steve, I'd like for you to pull on your professional expertise, talk about what it does to people to live with that.
Well, let me first talk about a little bit the fact that that the drug epidemic and the cocaine epidemic had a lot to do with gun violence. Actually, that peaked in about the 1990s, and gun violence has been going down since then, but unfortunately not enough. But the other point is that other countries have the drugs also, but they don't have this level of violence associated with them. What's unique or is exceptional about the United States is that we have not dealt with the gun problem. Mm-hmm. We have tried to deal with the drug problem, and in fact, some places are now getting even saying we're going to stop some of the elements of the drug war that were so counterproductive, but not the guns. And the other thing that's interesting is that if you look across the United States, this is an urban problem, but the incidence in various urban communities is wildly different. And that's because some communities have been much more effective at addressing the problem than others, of which the most remarkable has to be New York City. In the 1990s, New York City was having 2,000 homicides a year. Last year, they had about 400, less than that, actually, but 290.
Yeah, I think there was just a New York Times story saying that London now had surpassed New York in terms of homicides.
Well, it might. Whereas we had 175. So our homicide rate was about seven times their homicide rate. And I think part of the problem is that in the New York City area, they have, among other things, probably a lot more police and maybe somewhat different policing in the sense that the policing targets firearms in a particular way, not targeting just crime. One of the things that, frankly, has disappointed me a little with our mayor and the previous mayor is that they seem to talk as if we would get rid of crime, and that's going to help us get rid of guns. I think it would if you could do it, but I don't think that's possible. But I think you can target guns. Now, we are way behind the eight ball doing it in Indiana because our cities are much handicapped compared to some of the other cities in the fact that we have such permissive firearm regulation or lack thereof. In New York City, you have to, if someone has a handgun in New York City, it has to be registered. They have to have a permit from the city of New York to carry it. They have to have a cause to carry it. If you don't do that, you get into a good deal of trouble, as a professional football player found out when he was carrying a gun for which he had a permit in Florida and dancing in a nightclub and shot himself in the leg and found out he had a two-year 2.5-year prison sentence. Now, I don't think he had to serve it, but it was a felony conviction and taken very seriously. And I think we just don't take that stuff seriously. I had a relative who was going to Canada. He's a police officer, and he had a gun locked up in the box of his in the back of his truck. He wasn't planning to go to Canada, but he lives in Michigan. He got on the wrong ramp and ended up ready to go into Canada. A guy asked him, said, "Hey, do you have a firearm?" And he said, "Well, yeah, I'm a police officer. It's in the back." And he said, "Well, you can't bring that to Canada." And he said, "Look, I'm going to give you a good turn. I'm not going to arrest you, and I'm going to let you turn around and not come into Canada. But had you brought that gun into Canada, we would arrest you, and you'd been banned from ever coming back to Canada." Canada has about 2 handguns per 100,000 people. We have about 35. Our homicide rate is about 7 or 8 times there. So I think a lot of it has to do with social problems. But communities that have dealt with the gun side of it in a positive way that says, look, we got to do some things to stop this, and our citizens can put up with some restrictions because it's going to make them safer and it's going to make their city safer, whereas ours has been, well, no, we have this religious attitude toward firearms.
Mm-hmm.
Can't regulate firearms. Can't even keep firearms from being built that a 2-year-old can fire. That's what's, in a way, holding us back, and that's what makes it so tough for his department to get to this problem.
Yeah, Chief, I want to pull you in on some of that, because obviously you work with firearms. You are accustomed to them. But if I'm hearing a common theme or motif to all of these discussions, it is that the gun by itself escalates things. The thing with a gun is that it really takes only a twitch to turn what would be a dispute or an argument into a tragedy.
Yeah, definitely. And, one of the things that we've done as a department, we've always had a pretty good relationship with our federal partners, but I think here as of late, it's even gotten better. I would agree with Steve that the things that are happening in New York are incredible, the way they have gone about reducing their violence through their laws would be something that would be great to see here. But there's variables there. There's reasons why that doesn't happen. And I'm not a politician, so I don't know all the ins and outs to it. I think we would.
I'll say it so you don't have to. I mean, the state legislature has taken away a lot of communities' ability to deal with this problem on their own. I mean, they've restricted the ways that you can restrict access to guns,
right,
even in a specific community.
Well, and because of that, we rely more on those partnerships with the federal partners in order to get federal charges filed on those who are using weapons for various crimes in order to get a longer sentencing. And we've had some success in that. We'll continue down that path, and I'm sure it'll get better as time goes on, but we would still probably look for some changes in the law I think that would get us to where we need to be probably a little quicker.
We are talking about how communities can and should respond to gun-related violence here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Derek has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Derek, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Certainly.
My first time calling you to this show.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to jump in here. The gentleman said something about the sanctity of life, mm-hmm, and how it's not being respected anymore. And I, just befuddled me because I don't know when in this country's history where the sanctity of life has fully been realized. When we have slaves coming in, or even the Constitution granting someone that looks like me, who is African American, as only 60% human, and then the racist past of the last 150 years has just, when has the sanctity of life been something that has been taught? And it's interesting that we have the debate about taking guns away from African Americans, or we hyper focus on that and those statistics. But I think, in the last 30 or 40 years, the narrative has been black people with guns is dangerous. It's something that should be legislated against, something that should be fought against, and that seeps into the consciousness and the biasness of our politicians and our law enforcement, et cetera. So it's like, but the white person with a gun, like, you know, Bundy over in the Southwest, he can have an armed standoff with the cops, and he's a hero. He's on the cover of Time magazine. He's all over the place. Of course, you know, he did end up getting arrested, but the narrative was what's much different. And it's just our relationship with guns, religiously, as someone said, is more of a religious sort of context with race and how we view certain groups in this country.
Thanks very much for the call and for making that point. So, Reverend Harrison, and I think, you know, the perfect illustration of this is the guy, I can't remember his name at the moment, who shot up in Minnesota in front of his girlfriend. They were in the car, you know, and he was trying to say, I have a firearm, I have a permit to carry it, and all of that. And, you know, it was another one of the police shootings that that triggered a lot of unrest. If the circumstances had been different, you got to believe that the National Rifle Association would have rushed to his defense and the defense of his family and the people who loved him. Instead, they stayed silent all the way through that because he was African American.
Well, I think you really have to deal with that issue, and I think there are two separate issues here, and I always hear that issue, but my reality, you know, is that I've been doing 10 Point for about 20 years now, and I have been to literally hundreds of homicide scenes, and mm-hmm. we deal with all of these families that are broken because of this violence, and they feel like nobody really cares, you know, about them and their plight and what their family is experiencing. And I just believe in the sanctity of all human life, regardless of color, regardless of age. And I think that certainly has to be valued. And we have to look at this. And that's why I say it has to be looked at as a national issue. How do we address all forms of gun violence in this country that is taking the lives of human beings, whether it be through suicide, whether it be through street violence or school violence? We have to come up with some way to address this national epidemic.
You've been doing this for 20 years. Do you feel like you've made any progress?
I think we have. I think we have in some areas, and then some areas I feel like we haven't. When you look at the numbers, you know, the last 3 or 4 years, it gets frustrating.
And that, I think, I mean, Chief, I'm going to ask you, I mean, having to deal with all of this, I would think, has to take a toll on police officers, psychological, emotional. How do you deal with it?
Well, we have a very good employee assistance program. We have various people that can recommend officers that appear to be showing signs of not being able to deal with certain circumstances. We're able to take care of them and get them counseling and those kind of things. But you're right, it does take an effect. And sometimes we don't see it. Sometimes we don't see it in time. But we know it's there because they care also. There's not a man or woman on the department that I know, whether in homicide or just a street officer, that doesn't care what's going on in this community. And they will work hard and tirelessly to try to figure these things out, try to make the arrests that need to happen. So we try to keep an eye on them, and we rely on supervisors and other officers to let us know when they see issues in a particular officer.
We are talking about the ways that gun violence can affect communities and the people within them on No Limits today, and how, as a community, we should respond to gun-related violence. My guests are the Reverend Charles Harrison of the Indy 10-Point Coalition, Assistant Police Chief Randall Taylor of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, and Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence. If you want to join the conversation, Please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about how gun-related violence affects communities and the people within those communities and how those communities should respond to gun-related violence. My guests are the Reverend Charles Harrison of the Indy 10-Point Coalition, Assistant Police Chief Randall Taylor of Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, and Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence. Before we went to the break, Steve, we were talking about the the issue of race and guns, responding to a caller named Derek. You had a thought, and we didn't have time to get to it before we went to it, so I want to give you a shot now.
Well, what I wanted to somehow get across is that homicide rates and race right now in the United States are a peculiarity of our social circumstances. The highest homicide rates we've ever seen were in the California gold fields before law came to them. And in the Old West, there were very high homicide rates in some of the Western cities. In fact, we have whole TV shows about that, and these did not involve African Americans. And in fact, in both of those cases, the way that, certainly in the Old West, the way they brought it down is they began to regulate guns. Mm-hmm. There was a big sign in Dodge City that said, check your guns when you come into Dodge, so that cowboys who wouldn't come in and get drunk and get in fights and kill each other. And it worked.
Especially with the, 120-proof alcohol that they used to have back in those days, too.
But again,
you're amazed that they survived the experience long enough to lift a gun.
And when they focused on guns in that situation, they did. And just now, because sometimes it'll sound like, or people who speak in my position are saying, take away guns from African Americans. No, it's not to take away guns from African Americans. It's take away guns from individuals within a community who are causing these difficulties and shouldn't have guns, whether they're white or black, because most of them have criminal histories and they're not even legally carrying them. And the reason they're using them has to do with cultural factors related to that particular community at this particular time. Now, if all those other cultural features could be removed, there probably wouldn't be the same level of gun violence. The other point is, but while the gun violence is going on, it makes it so much harder to deal with all the other problems.
And I guess this is a perfect tee up. We need to talk about solutions. How we get past the impasse on this, how we get to a point where we are talking about ways to solve this problem. I'll admit, it's one of the most, normally I don't express opinions in this show, but just dealing with this question is one of the more frustrating aspects of public discourse these days, because it seems like there are all kinds of forces pushing you to one extreme or the other. For many of us, I think we are trying to figure out a way to do what Steve has talked about, find ways to keep guns from people who shouldn't have them while still preserving the rights of gun owners who do abide by the law and honor basic morality. And we don't get a whole lot of help. I've had probably the NRA's chief spokesperson here in the state, Indiana Representative Jim Lucas, on this program a couple of times. The last time he was in here, he said not only was the Second Amendment an absolute right, but it extended to nuclear weapons. If we're dealing with that level of kind of intransigence, how do we get to a point where we arrive at something that a community can do?
There's a better word for that. It's ignorance. Yeah. He hasn't read the Heller decision. Justice Sirica made very clear in the Heller decision that there's plenty of limits on.
Well, and Scalia did too.
Scalia
did as well.
It doesn't include nuclear weapons or even automatic weapons. It had to do only with the complete ban of a particular weapon, which was a handgun at the time.
So I'll start with the chief on this. How do you think we get to a point as a community where we can talk about this without diving into our foxholes, as it were?
Right. Well, and we've made efforts to meet with the community on all types of topics, but this being one of them, and we come to the same impasse. You know, where do you start? Do you how much time do you work with the youth? You know, a lot of people will think it's a matter of helping the youth understand the importance of life and gun violence and how it's affecting them. Other people look at the actual just who gets to carry the guns, those kind mm-hmm. of things. How are we going to limit that? So I'll be honest, I don't know of which path you take, and you could add all kinds of variables in there after that. Best I think we've been able to do is at least be open to hearing the thoughts of the community and the ideas that they have. But it's overwhelming to some standpoint because there's so many different avenues, so many different things to look at. Wish you could just point it at one thing and say, let's focus here and take care of it. But in this case, there's really not.
Steve.
Well,
and then I'll
talk a little bit from my medical background. Mm-hmm. If there was an epidemic of influenza or something else mm-hmm. like that going on in certain communities, we would be looking for, well, what are best practices? Mm-hmm. What's the best way to do this? Well, in the United States, the one way to approach that, which I don't know of anybody who's done, is to look at all the cities that have one-digit homicide rates and all the cities that have two-digit or 20 or more homicide rates and try to see, well, what, you know, what gun laws exist, what's the makeup of them in terms of who's living there and all the social factors, how many police officers are there per person, what are the police doing, you know, and then police in various cities, for instance, like cancer specialists, they would develop a protocol and they try three different protocols in different cities and look at the results. So you'd be saying this is a public health problem. We want to try public health type solutions, and that simply doesn't exist because we just don't look at it that way.
Reverend Harris.
But when you hear people talk about it in the community, the one thing that people keep referring to, because we have had some successes in Indianapolis and some areas that used to have a high level of gun violence has declined, where there was a high level of homicides. But unless we are willing to begin to really address the root causes and the factors that are leading people down this path of this kind of violence that we're seeing in particularly, you know, in many urban cities across the country, we're never going to get our hands around it. I think New York has done a remarkable job, but New York has also invested a lot of resources into addressing the problem and to community groups that are on the front lines, that are the ones interfacing with the individuals that are most likely to be the victims and the perpetrators of violent crime, and redirecting their lives and putting them on the pathway of success. I think that can be done in any city. I think it can be done in any neighborhood. But we have to recognize what are these leading causes and factors that could have led a young man like myself, which led my brother down the wrong path, but before I made the wrong choice, there were people that intervened in my life and helped me make a better choice. And I think there are a lot of factors from broken families to education, you know, to high unemployment, to how we deal with people who come out of prison who have served their time and have paid their debt to society, but many of them come back and they feel like they still have the mark of Cain on them and they're still being punished for crimes that they went and served and paid their debt for, but the doors of opportunity are closed. So many of them end up going back and doing what got them in trouble in the first place, and it becomes a revolving door. So I think there are things that we can do if we are committed to addressing these root causes that is leading people down this path.
We are talking about how communities can and should respond to gun-related violence here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Theo has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi. Great. I'm glad I got to offer my opinion here.
Certainly.
It's a great discussion. If you watch the news, you can't get around it on a daily basis. But this has gone on for more than 20 years in a serious way. There's a lot of things need to be done. And yeah, the root cause needs to be looked at, but how do we really make a change over a 5-year span? It seems to me that most of these, I don't know if it's a majority or a vast majority, but if handgun ownership can be limited to anyone over the age of 25, and if that could have a difference, I mean, why aren't we getting something like that as a referendum on when we vote? I mean, a question on our, you know, would you be in favor of something like this? And just get a response from the public how they would feel about enacting something like that. And I mean, if you're, I don't care if you're a rural white guy or an inner city black man or woman, if you have a handgun, you know, you're going to jail. It's that serious, I think.
Thanks very much for the call and for the question. Reverend Harrison.
Well, even if you did that, and I, you know, I would pose this, you know, and we have Assistant Chief Randy Taylor here, but how do you stop? How would you stop the black market where I can buy any kind of gun I want on the streets as easy as I can buy drugs without a permit? Any mm-hmm. any kind of gun I want, any kind of assault weapon I want. How do we address that problem? Because I don't think it's that simple. I think we got to get to the hearts of people and why people need these guns in the first place and why they're using them with a criminal intent.
Chief, I'm going to throw that because that is one of the complicating factors. I mean, most conservative estimates say that there are somewhere north of 300 million privately owned firearms in this country of 330 million. The ones that, at least to my mind, seem a little more accurate peg the number closer to 400 million, which means we've got more than one gun per person in this country. I mean, are we at some level trying to, you know, close the barn door after the horse has fled?
Right. Well, and we've had some great success here recently of getting more guns off the street. But as you said, that, I mean, we can go into almost any of the underserved neighborhoods and you can find someone that'll sell you a gun for as cheap as probably $25. And to the caller's point, some of the things that he's suggesting could possibly work, but only works with people who are going to abide by the law. Mm-hmm. Those who are outside of that scope, it's not going to matter to them. We already know there's been so many guns manufactured that you couldn't put a cap on it now, and you wouldn't see probably any change that we could really decipher for probably 10, 20 years or more.
In fairness, I think Steve's point earlier, and I'm going to try to make it for you, Steve, because my phone bank is completely lit up and I want to try to get at least one or two more callers in, would have been, you know, if we change the gun laws so that having the gun is the reason that that law enforcement gets involved, that you can arrest people at that point rather than having to wait for a moment when there's a body lying on the street, that creates a different dynamic. Is that a fair representation of their argument?
The other thing I would say is
that the point of intervention is earlier.
Well, I would also say some cities have done a much better job.
Yeah.
They're doing it somehow. I mean, we've got a whole bunch of cities that have under 10, and they have similar. New York City, for instance, has more immigrants and more racial diversity and so on than we do. But they've managed to get the gun rate down. Now, they've done it. It's doable. The problem is, and it's not that people don't want it, one as the people want a lot of things, and our legislature simply won't do them. Things that would help, they won't solve every problem, but gun checks for every you have to go through a process if you're going to transfer a gun. If you don't do it, it's illegal. There's a whole bunch of things that could be done, and everybody knows what they are. It's just that our legislature is so in the hands of the gun industry that they won't do it.
We are talking about how communities should respond to gun-related violence here on No Limits. Jennifer, you're on the air.
You might give a comment about maybe working with organizations like the Julian Center on domestic violence or just domestic partners or the 911 calls that come in with people that are known to be violent to see if they could hook that up with restricting gun ownership or permits, that sort of thing. school, to talking about the nature of respect and what that means and that sort of thing. So I'll take my comment off the air.
All right. Thanks very much, Jennifer.
Mm-hmm.
Reverend Harrison.
Certainly, I would certainly be in favor of that, because we do see a lot of domestic, you know, violence in our city and in our society today. And I think we have to find a better way of getting those weapons out of the hands of those who are threatening.
We're talking about gun related violence here on No Limits. Theo, you're on the air.
Thank you, and good afternoon to everybody.
Certainly, I'm going to ask you to be quick because we're getting tight on time.
Okay, yes, sir. My sister, and she was killed a few years ago by her husband, and her ex-husband, I should say, killed her boyfriend, and then he ultimately killed himself in a police chase. And so I understand the dynamics of homicide firsthand and suicide. What I would like to just briefly comment on is the fact that as black people, we have to be able to learn how to love self again. Self-hate is so embedded in the minds of our people that when we see each other, we see each other through the eyes of Satan. When we look at each other, we don't see value in each other anymore, because most of us, when we look in the mirror, we see a devalued reality. We see ends, and that's why we're so comfortable with using the N-word as a term of endearment for each other, because we see each other as less than what we are. So when we come back to the knowledge of self and understand that the root of us is God himself, then we'll look at each other in a way where we'll put a gun down and be willing to come to the table and talk again. Because
Theo, I'm going to have to. We're getting right up to the end of the program
here.
So thank you very much for the call. I appreciate that. So I'm going to ask this. I mean, obviously, this is such a large subject that it's difficult to deal with even in the space of an hour.
Yes.
When we've devoted it. We do continue these conversations on social media on our Facebook page. I'd like to ask if each of you would be willing to visit Facebook and continue the discussion. I'd like to ask our listeners to carry it over there as well. Would you be willing to do that,
sure.
Reverend Harrison?
Sure.
Steve?
Well, I'm willing to try.
Okay. We can get somebody to help you with the technology.
I'm not a great Facebook fan.
Chief Taylor.
I'm in the same boat with Steve.
All right. Well, we'll get you a young person to help you with that. All right. I'd like to thank my guests, the Reverend Charles Harrison, Assistant Police Chief Randall Taylor, and Steve Dunlop of Hoosiers Concerned About Gun Violence, for what has been a very lively conversation. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator Scott McAllister. Technical Producers Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.